I'll be giving a series of lectures on the physics of scattering amplitudes, largely in gauge theories and largely in n equals 4 superheating metals. And I just want to start off giving a brief motivation for why these set of questions are interesting. This is a subject that I've come to feel very, very strongly about its importance over the past couple of years. It's also a subject that's been developing just at an absolutely explosive pace over the past 5-7 years and the past 2 or 3 years particularly. And I want to put the motivation for talking about it in a broader context first before going into the details. So as you all know, one of the central challenges that we face in fundamental physics today is figuring out how to get rid of and replace our idea of space-time with something else. And this is related to, this is forced on us, actually as I'll discuss in the next little bit, it's forced on us by a very, very simple combination of both quantum mechanics and gravity. Quantum mechanics and gravity together make it simply impossible to talk about any local observables. The reason for this, people give formal reasons for this having to do with the diffeomorphism invariance, which are not really the point, because diffeomorphism is invariance is a gauge symmetry, so it's meaningless. So whether or not something is or isn't diffeomorphism invariant is up to you. But it's actually something physical about gravity. It's really something physical about gravity and its universal attraction that gives rise to the problem. And the basic point is this. Let's say you want to measure any local quantity. You want to measure, let's say, a two-point function for some scalar field, or more prosaically, the temperature in this room, the way that coffee bends. But an experiment that takes place in a fixed region of space, then we should ask, what do we have to do to get a sharp measurement? Okay. And because of quantum mechanics, there's always two infinities involved in any sharp measurement. One of them is that we have to do the experiment infinitely often. Okay, so you really do the experiment over and over and over again. You get different results every time you measure the two-point function because the world is quantum mechanical. But if you do the experiment often enough, the distribution becomes more and more sharply peaked around some value that you call the two-point function. Okay, so that's one infinity. You have to do the experiment infinitely often. Another infinity is that you have to do the experiment with an infinitely large apparatus. And that's because of decoherence. That's because in order to come up with an arbitrarily sharp result, you have to correlate states of the apparatus with the states of the system. But there's always some exponentially tiny probability of a quantum fluctuation in the system itself that would make the result of what you wrote down meaningless. If I were to do an experiment in this room, I could measure the two-point function, I could design a perfect experiment, I could reduce the systematic errors and the statistical errors and get things down sharper and sharper and sharper, but at some point, I can't discount the chance with a probability of order e to the minus 10 to the 30, which is e to the minus the number of things I'm made of, that I fluctuated, that I turned into a ball of dust, or that I wrote down the wrong answer because my brain fluctuated. Okay. So that means that any sharp result, because of quantum mechanics, involves these two infinities. We have to do the experiment infinitely often, and we have to do it with infinitely large apparatuses. And now gravity makes one or both of those infinities impossible. Okay? For example, it makes the infinity of making the apparatus infinitely large impossible, because making the apparatus infinitely large would necessarily make it infinitely massive if you want to keep the measurement to the confines of this room. And that means that if I want to do a measurement, any local measurement at all, I simply can't reduce the systematic error down to zero. There's nothing I can do to reduce the systematic error down to zero. As I start making the apparatus bigger and bigger, at some point there's so much mass in the room that I collapse the room into a black hole, and I can't make the measurement anymore. So that's a, so what, when we say there's no local observables, and our experimental colleagues ask us, so what the heck am I doing in my lab all the time, you idiot, you know? Of course there's local observables. What am I doing? What's the answer to this question? The answer is you're doing whatever the heck you're doing is not perfectly sharply defined. There's no experiment you can possibly do that will reduce the systematic error on the quantity you're measuring to zero. And if you're doing the experiment in a room which has some size R, then there's an inevitable, because of gravity, there's an inevitable error. You cannot reduce the systematic error beyond e to the negative, the entropy of the black hole that would eat up the room. Okay, which is important, e to the negative R squared over g Newton, e to the negative m prime squared R squared. Okay? So that's just the fact. There's no local observables because of dynamical gravity. You see, it has nothing to do with diffeomorphisms. If I sent m quantum to infinity, the theory would be just as diffeomorphism invariant as it was before. But this would not be a problem. There are local observables. Okay? It's gravity that makes it impossible to have local observables. So what do? We retreat to boundaries. Okay? We retreat to the boundaries of space-time where we can make the apparatuses infinitely big. We can do the experiment infinitely often. And then the sorts of observables that we talked about are boundary observables. Okay? So most famously, in the ADS-CFT correspondence, we talk about boundary correlation functions. And this is the startling fact. There's no inside of space-time. So there's no observable associated with local measurements. It must be the inside of the space-time is somehow an emergent concept, emerging out of something else. And so that's very, it's a very dramatic fact that we need to get some handle on. You might naively think that all of these effects are exponentially small until you get down to the Planck length, which is true. The most obvious effects are exponentially small. It's possible for some of these exponentially small effects to become amplified if you do sufficiently refined measurements. So if you do an order e to the m Planck squared r squared measurement, or in any other way, get a large e to the plus s number involved somewhere, then it's possible that these tiny errors actually accumulate and give you a very surprising deviation from standard expectations. That's what, for example, happens in the black hole information problem. You can only decide whether information has or hasn't been lost if you do measurements on at least S over 2 of the Hawking quanta that come out of the black hole, where S is the black hole entropy. You can't even tell the difference. The issue doesn't even arise until you do that many measurements. But you see, your antennas should now be pricked for wondering that something might be wrong because you're doing an incredibly large number of measurements. Incredibly exclusive questions you're asking. So there's a potential for these tiny violations of locality to pile up and give you an order one deviation from what you expect from long distance physics. Nonetheless, these are all qualitative arguments that tell us the inside of the space-time doesn't exist. Nothing beats having a working example of how that comes about. And the working example that we have is ADS-CFT. As you all know, and you've all heard these slogans, ADS-CFT is wonderful. Now, the one thing it doesn't tell us is how to think about emergent space-time with the emphasis on time. And the reason is, and this is largely why it was possible for us to discover it, as incredible and mind-blowing a thing as it is, it was so accessible to humanity. Because in this particular case, the time that lives on the boundary is the same as the time that lives in the bulk. So the theory that you're talking about, this dual theory, still has time. It's still a normal quantum mechanical theory. In fact, it's so normal it's a normal particle theory. Okay? So it's a gateway drug. ADS-CFT is a gateway drug into this idea that space-time is emergent. But it doesn't force you to give everything up. It doesn't, in particular, it lets you think about still a totally normal theory with ordinary time. Now, as we've understood more and more things, it's clear that the real situation that we have to deal with in our actual universe is very, very different. And in fact, the very, very hardest set of questions have to do with cosmology. The very hardest set of those have to do with making some sense of eternal inflation. And the reason there is that there's even less for us to talk about. You see, even before, there's even less for us to precisely talk about. even before talking about what the theory is or what the measure is or any of these questions, it's important to ask what could possibly be precisely measured. Okay, what could possibly be the output of some experiment that would give a totally sharp answer for which a putative theory would predict that number? See, theories in physics don't predict fuzz, they predict sharp numbers. And we have to figure out what those sharp numbers correspond to. What observables do those sharp numbers correspond to? And the difficulty in cosmology is that often that second infinity of doing the experiment infinitely often gets removed from us. Now, sometimes in cosmology there's a little bit left. If we're talking about an ordinary situation where we have an expanding universe, there's no cosmological constant, it just expands out into flat space. Okay, there's one last observable left to us, which is we might imagine sitting on our back and looking out at the sky and counting how many blue stars are there, how many red stars are there, how many green stars are there, making a big table of all of those guys. And we get infinitely many blue stars and red stars and green stars, and we can measure the light with infinitely big apparatuses because the universe is becoming infinitely big. And so that's a sharp number that we can predict, the fraction of red stars and blue stars and green stars. It's not much, okay? It's not much, but that's life. I mean, our life in physics for the past 100 years has been, for the past 120 years, has been learning to deal with being able to predict fewer and fewer and fewer things, okay? You think about, this is nothing compared to what was possible to quantum, you know, like, Laplace would have committed suicide if he knew what was coming in the 1900s. Okay, so nothing compared to that. Nonetheless, okay, there's something left. There's something left. You can talk about the fraction of red, blue, green stars. That's otherwise known as the wave function of the universe. Okay, so when there's a sensible notion of a wave function of the universe, which in an infinitely large universe tells you the relative frequencies of blue stars, green stars, and so on. Okay, so that's the last gasp. So we had boundary correlation functions in empty de Sitter space. In the other extreme in cosmology, we maybe have this fraction of blue, green, red stars. Or if we have an accelerated universe or a terminal inflation or any of those things, it's not obvious what we have at all. Okay, there's not clearly anything left that we can, in principle, measure with arbitrary precision. And there have been various attempts in the context of eternal inflation, if we tunnel out into flat space, to associate some perfectly sharp observables associated with the guys that live in the regions that tunnel out into flat space. But it's still not clear, after all this effort, ignoring whether or not there's a dual CFT or this or that, it's not even clear there are such observables associated with those people. Okay. So again, before we're talking about the theories, we should figure out what the theories are supposed to talk about. It's not clear at all that there is anything there. That's, I think, the sort of biggest conceptual challenge in our kind of physics today, which is ultimately going back to the problem, how do you do quantum mechanics when there isn't a good separation between observer and system? The standard way of talking about quantum mechanics necessitates not only a separation, but the implication of infinite systems and infinite measurements, and those infinities are idealizations that seem to be removed from us in the context of cosmology. That seems like a very hard problem. And it's possible to try to make some frontal assaults on those problems, and several people have done so and continue to do so. You're going to see how this is getting related to scattering amplitudes in a second. This is how I got into thinking about scattering amplitudes, was by exactly these sorts of thinking about these sorts of questions. But realizing that there's some genuinely new ideas are needed to make sense of these very, very hard problems. But it also seems like a very, very large leap from where we are right now. Especially since there is something, a set of problems, just one step harder than the ones that we figured out already, that we still don't understand very well, but which it seems quite clear that understanding them will definitely provide a springboard to thinking about everything else properly. Because understanding this set of problems is going to force us to figure out where time comes from as well. To understand not just the emergence of space, but the emergence of space-time. And all of the difficulties with cosmology have to do with the fact that the boundaries we're talking about, the places where observables might be defined, maybe they're not defined, they all have to do with the fact that there is evolution in time. So we clearly need to understand where time comes from. And we have to understand it in a much more controlled setting than these infinitely hard problems having to do with cosmology. Fortunately, we can, because the next set of problems after empty consider space are to understand flat space. Okay? Before going on to positive cosmological constant and everything else, it seems to make sense to understand fully the physics of flat space. The observables in flat space, which were understood long before the observables associated with ADS, are scattering amplitudes. By the way, the whole argument that the only observables in gravity are associated with the boundary, all of these things, essentially holographic ideas, right, that say that only the boundary makes sense. These are not modern ideas. These ideas go back to DeWitt in the 1960s, who understood these things perfectly, okay, and was therefore motivated to start understanding scattering amplitudes. He, in fact, did some of the first computations of scattering amplitudes, both in gravity and in gauge theory, and started seeing some of the surprises that exponentiated since then. But anyway, so the observable in flat space is the S matrix. Okay, and so what we'd like to do is see if we can understand the S matrix. Now you might say, well, we perfectly well know how to talk about the S matrix, let's say for perturbative theories, gauge theories, gravity, and so on. Feynman solved this problem a long time ago. Okay? You just draw lots and lots of Feynman diagrams and you add them all up. Done. Okay? Where are all these tricky things coming into play? These tricky things maybe come into play if you're talking about making a black hole, near the singularity of a black hole. Maybe something funny is going on there. But surely, if you're just talking about perturbative gauge theory, perturbative gravity, scattering amplitudes, there is no better way of computing them than Feynman diagrams. There is no dual theory for them, right?
What do you mean by perturbative gravity?
You just compute low-energy gravity scattering amplitudes. You can imagine computing tree amplitudes, maybe some loop amplitudes, maybe.
So the loop is the problem, tree, of course.
No, but the loop is a problem, and maybe there's counter terms you need to start talking about more and more of them. Maybe I just start including higher dimension operators and systematically figure out how they affect the low energy theory. Still, I mean, there is such a thing as perturbative low energy gravity amplitudes. Even the whole theory, string theory, whatever. There is still the question of figuring out how to compute the scattering amplitudes. So you might think, if you want to study these questions about gravity, ask the questions where they become important. Ask the questions where these effects become of order one. These are questions about black holes. These are questions about, you know, the Big Bang singularity. There are questions like that. Don't ask. It's not going to be interesting to ask the question anywhere else. And I think this attitude turns out to, and if we believe that, then there's many wonderful theoretical puzzles and lots of constraints and so on, and it's been a great activity that's been going on for many years and will go on for many years. But there's no data to guide us, right? Because we have to go to the Planck scale to see any of these things. Fortunately, I think this attitude is basically incorrect. And that, in fact, there is a very powerful imprint of the underlying theory without space-time, this underlying dual description that we are looking for now for flat space. There is a way of looking for it, in fact, clues for what it is, and the sort of thing, the sort of shape it should take, already sitting there in the structure of ordinary scattering amplitudes for ordinary theories, even without gravity. Even gauge theories, even the dynamics of gauge theories, scattering amplitudes from gauge theories, have clues in them that tell us, and it directly address these questions about the emergence of space-time. This may sound crazy at first, but in fact, it has a it it's part of a very long-standing tradition in physics. Imagine, just to give you an analogy, then I'll just go on for a few more minutes and I'll start getting to the meat of the matter. But imagine that you're a classical physicist in 1850, okay? You believe in Laplacian determinism, Newton's laws, everything, okay? But someone came and told you they have a clue from the future, okay? Determinism is gone. Funny things happen at tiny scales in phase space, right? That's it. That's all they tell you. It's like it's the ghost of theorist future, okay? Comes and just gives this hint and goes away. What would you do with this information? Okay. Well, it looks astonishing, right? Because you say, how can determinism possibly be gone? Determinism is hardwired into our laws of nature. You know, I can't take Newton's laws and just tinker them a little bit and make them a little bit non-deterministic. Okay. What the heck could this other theory possibly be that pulls the rug out from us so dramatically? And if you thought about it some more, maybe I should make the year 1780, just to be more historically accurate. If you thought about it some more, you might say, well, that's just nuts. There's no way, because whatever that other theory is, it has some parameter, there's some limit, there's some correspondence limit. Somehow, it has to smoothly connect to our theory. Our theory isn't wrong, it's damn good, right? What possible small perturbation could we make to our theory that makes it all of a sudden not deterministic? Okay? This person isn't coming and telling determinism a little bit off. This is, there's no determinism fundamentally at all. It's just gone, right? How could that possibly be incorporated into your picture of the world? Well, you might think, maybe what I should do is think about what funny things could happen at small areas in phase space. Okay? Because that's another clue that you were given. And maybe you think for a while, you have the brilliant idea, you put phase space on a lattice, okay? Oh wow, phase space on a lattice, that's just awesome. You think a little more and you realize that's actually tough with Liouville's theorem, okay? There's diffeomorphism invariance in phase space, and just putting it on a lattice breaks it. This analogy should be of interest to people who think about loop quantum gravity, okay? We have almost the same words today, but anyway. That's clearly wrong. You might take that as a clue, but it's definitely it's not the right way to go. You might, with some work, come up with semi-classical ideas like the Born-Sommerfeld quantization rules or something like that, and get some inkling of what that theory is like. But still, you're not seeing this zeroth order big perturbation that the term is gone. But there is another thing you could do, which would not require you to think about what's going on at tiny distances in phase space and modify the theory you have. You could ask, the fact that there is this other new theory where determinism is gone, and the fact that it needs some correspondence limit that takes us back to our theory, must mean that there is some way of formulating our current theory where determinism is not manifest. That's the only possible way there could be a correspondence limit. And you would think, and you would think, and you invent the least action principle. Okay. The least action principle is just a reformulation of classical physics. It's nothing new, it's just a reformulation of classical physics. But it's a reformulation with a very, very important feature. Determinism is not manifest in the least action principle. In fact, when you first learn it, it's very startling. You say the particle goes from A to B, as if it sniffs out all possible paths and takes the path with least action.
Okay.
Well, of course it ends up being completely equivalent to Newton's laws. But in the formulation, determinism is not manifest. Determinism is instead an output. Okay? You discover, given the rules for how you do the variation, that, oh, with these rules for doing the variation, the actual, it looks like local equations of motion, which are deterministic, but the basic laws is not deterministic. The statement is not deterministic. Okay? Determinism is an emergent concept from the point of view of the principle of least action. Other things become obvious. The symmetries, the link with conservation laws, all sorts of other things become manifest. But determinism is not manifest. In fact, this is not how things happened, because there was no ghost of theorist future. The way things happened is that people started doing harder and harder calculations in classical mechanics. And they found that Newton's laws were increasingly cumbersome. And they invented the principle of least action as a wonderful reformulation of the theory that just allowed the calculations to become simpler. And it did bother a few of them that there, that sitting there was this completely different outlook on what the world looks like, right? The term does not seem to be manifest. But it's just a rewriting. There's nothing new. There's no H-bar, nothing, right?
So those people really did sound non-deterministic back then?
No, absolutely. In fact, I mean, people have said, well, I can tell you about the history a lot later, but people thought of the principle of least action as the proof of the divine. Right, for telling you that there's some preordained way things are, that everything is as perfect as can be, and so on. Okay, so anyway, the history is fascinating, but I can tell you more about it later. So the message here is that it's this playing around with the theories you have and finding other ways of formulating them, which make different features manifest, has had a long and glorious tradition in our subject. And in fact, the point is that the different formulations can be of different degrees of utility in making contact with the next theory up. Okay? Newton's laws are a terrible way of making the leap to quantum mechanics. The principle of least action, which is just a rewriting of Newton's laws, is a wonderful way of making the leap to quantum mechanics. Because after playing around with it for a while, you might start wondering, what are all those other paths for? Do they have any point in life? Okay. And eventually, you might come up with that. This is perhaps a little far-fetched, but it's you might come up with the idea of quantum mechanics. It's a natural deformation of that theory that you have. So once again, it's not quantum mechanics. It turned out to be useful for predicting orbits of planets and all sorts of things. There's no H-bar in it, but in a sense, it did almost all of the job for going to quantum mechanics. Okay. It figured out some way of talking about completely deterministic physics, but didn't put determinism in by hand. That's the biggest trick, right? After that, it's a little modification from there to allow the possibility that just determinism there at all. Okay. But most of the trick was done, or a large part of the psychological hurdle was overcome by realizing that there's this second way of talking about things where determinism isn't manifest. Okay, I claim that that's exactly the situation we're in today, with the word determinism replaced by the word locality. So we have quantum mechanics, we have quantum field theory, we know, in this case, we have the ghost of theorist future. The ghost of theorist future is the thought experiments that tell us that local observables don't exist because of quantum mechanics and gravity. So we know that as a clue for what the correct formulation of physics looks like. Then the question is, what do we do? And a perfectly defensible and important set of things to do is to wonder what happens down at Planckian distances. But another thing that we could be doing is to try to reformulate the theories we know and love and have in a way that eviscerates space-time, takes it out completely, but gets the observable results back. It gives us the scattering amplitudes directly without talking about an evolution through the intermediary space-time. So that's a motivation for studying scattering amplitudes for ordinary theories, even without gravity, okay? Just ordinary gauge theories that we know and love. Now that was a long and highfalutin, a long and highfalutin set of arguments. Let me say one last thing about it, though. Unlike trying to figure out what's going on with the Planck scale using thought experiments or other things, this direction has the advantage of having an enormous amount of data. Okay? It's a gigantic amount of data. Every scattering amplitude that's ever been computed is data. Okay? Because it has to be reproduced by a putative dual theory. Okay? And you know when you're on the right track or you're not, because you're either computing them or you're not. There's no bullshit in this business. It's zero. Okay? It either works or it doesn't. Okay. So those were very, very highfalutin arguments for why there should be some way, some formulation of standard scattering amplitudes, just for gauge theories, where you don't put in space-time by hand, but space-time is an emergent concept, and perhaps other things are made more manifest. However, there's a much, much more pragmatic set of arguments, which remarkably line up in exactly the same direction. In fact, this is really the analog of people inventing the principle of least action to do the hard calculations. Okay? So here, you actually start trying to do gauge theory calculations of scattering amplitudes for anything other than 2-to-2 processes, and you run into the famous fact that Feynman diagrams suck. Okay? They just suck. So if you want to compute, and by the way, Feynman himself knew this, and complained to anyone who would listen that his methods were no good for many, many extra particles. Okay? But let's talk about a process like 2 gluons to 2 gluons going to 4 gluons. A process that is an important background to any search you're interested in at the LHC. Even relevant cuts can happen hundreds of thousands of times a second. Very, very important process. So if you count, there are 220 Feynman diagrams. There are tens of thousands of terms. I mean, it's just totally ridiculous. There are tens of thousands of terms. And yet, and people had to, and in fact, Park and Taylor, amongst other people, had to come up with tricks for computing them. It's hopeless to sum the Feynman diagrams. So you come up with tricks. At first it looks like tricks. Okay? Shortcuts to doing the calculations and so on. And what you find is extraordinary that the sum of these tens of thousands of terms are captured in either one term or three terms total.
In either.
Well, depending. So, for example, I'll give you the answer. If all the helicities are plus, the amplitude is zero. If all the helicities, so here we're imagining all the incoming, all momenta are incoming. If all the helicities are plus, but one of them are minus, the amplitude is also zero. If two of the helicities are minus, let's say for particles I and J, then, and I will review what this spinner helicity formalism means in a second, then the amplitude is this. But for now, you're just supposed to be impressed by the fact that it's one term, okay? Just a single term. And the most general configuration is with three pluses and three minuses, and I won't write it down, but it's three terms. Okay, they're a little bit more complicated than that, but there's three terms. Okay? This is just stunning. It's absolutely stunning. So Feynman diagrams are clearly hiding something. They're hiding a simplicity to the answer. Now, why are Feynman diagrams complicated? Feynman diagrams are complicated because they have one job to do in life. They make locality and unitarity manifest. That's the whole point. Okay? You get them from a Lagrangian, which comes from a path integral. Locality and unitarity are the things that are being made manifest by Feynman diagrams. If you have something like a phi to the fourth theory, or a phi cube theory, or a crappy theory like that, it turns out, I'll just tell you now, there is no extra simplicity to the answer compared to what you expect from Feynman diagrams. What you get is about as bad as what you expect. There's no hidden simplicity. The hidden simplicity starts for gauge theories, where the Feynman diagrams are much more complicated than for phi cubed or phi to the fourth theory, but the answers turn out to be much simpler than phi to the fourth theory. And remarkably enough, even though I won't talk about a lot in these lectures, for gravity, in a specific sense, they're simpler still. Even though the Feynman diagrams are now a complete nightmare. There's 80 terms in the cubic vertex for gravity in de Gondre gauge. Okay? It's just a total nightmare to do the calculations directly, but the answers are simpler, even simpler than in gauge theory in a specific sense. Okay? So already there's something really bizarre going on. That there's a complete inversion for what you think is simple and complicated in the actual answer. Forget about the process of getting the answer. The actual answer doesn't betray any of this fact. You wouldn't lead to expect the opposite from Feynman diagrams. But why is it? Where is this complexity in Feynman diagrams coming from? And why is it there in gauge theories and in gravity? And the reason, once again, has to do with the fact that it's making locality and unitarity manifest. It does that. So what is it? What is an actual scattering amplitude? An actual scattering amplitude in four dimensions is an object that's labeled by a giving a bunch of strings of plus ones and minus ones for the velocities of external particles and giving the momenta of the particles. And this deserves to be called an amplitude if when you do a Lorentz transformation on the momenta, you get a little group transformation on the velocities. Okay, so that's what a scattering amplitude is. We'll always imagine that all momenta are incoming. Okay? But that's not what you compute with Feynman diagrams. What you compute with Feynman diagrams are things that have tensor indices. And to get the actual amplitude, you dot these indices into polarization vectors. Okay. And then you hope that it's true, or you say that it's true, that these polarization vectors are like bifundamentals between the Lorentz group and the little group. Okay? They have the property that if you do a Lorentz transformation on them, on their mu index, you pick up a little group rotation on their helicity index. Okay? You pretend that such an object exists, and you dot into the amplitude and you get the answer. You mod squared and you go home. Okay?
Why do you pretend?
No, it's pretend because those objects don't exist. There's no such thing as a polarization vector. There's no such thing as a polarization vector that behaves as a bifundamental, where if you do a Lorentz transformation on it, you get a little group rotation on the index. Doesn't exist. The difficulty has to do with the famous fact that there's only two polarizations, let's say, of a spin one particle, or any massless high spin particle. And what actually happens is if you do if you have an epsilon mu of p, it can transform into lambda epsilon mu of p, but there's always something proportional to p mu that you can't get rid of. That's the basic problem, that there's two helicities, so, and there's simply no Lorentz invariant way of picking out two out of four helicities. Because I want to use a Lagrangian to make locality manifest, I have to have fields with mu indices. That's why the m's are Lorentz tensors. But I have 4 degrees of freedom here. I can try to knock it down by placing Lorentz invariant constraints on it, like that, which knocks it down to 3. But that's it. There's nothing else I can do. There are still 3 degrees of freedom, not 2, 3. And very concretely, what that means is, even if you say, okay, screw all this formal crap, I'm gonna just pick a frame and say, here are my polarization vectors, okay? When the particle's moving in the z direction, so if p mu is this, that's what I'm calling my polarization vectors. Don't give me a hard time. Go home, okay? That's fine. You're perfectly free to do that in some Lorentz frame. But in another Lorentz frame, it will not look like that. That's the problem. In another Lorentz frame, the corresponding epsilon will have a component proportional to p mu. There's simply no way of getting rid of that component that's proportional to p mu. And so what we have to do is identify, which is really a new thing, we have to identify epsilon mu and epsilon mu plus anything times p mu, and declare that they're the same physical state. It's a declaration. Okay? So the polarization vectors are not, don't give you, there's no unique polarization vector. There's a whole family of polarization vectors, all corresponding to the same physical state, differing by amounts proportional to p mu. Okay? Of course, this is nothing other than the momentum space version of gauge invariants. Okay? We have to demand that this is a redundancy. We have to demand that these give us the same physical state. So A mu and A mu, if it's coming from a Lagrangian, The only way you have a prayer for this to be true, and this means something very specific, right? This means that these mu's that we calculate have to satisfy that if you dot p mu into any of them, you have to get zero. Okay? Because it can't know which representative you chose. Okay? But depending on which representative you choose, they differ from by p mu. The only way the physical amplitudes are going to be invariant is if this is true. But now you have a tall order ahead of you. You have to figure out how to build a theory which is going to guarantee that this is true when you sum of all of its Feynman diagrams. The only way you have a prayer in hell of doing that is if you build all this redundancy into the theory. You build gauge redundancy into the theory, and so on. So gauge redundancy is the price we pay for making locality and unitarity as manifest as possible. Let me say it another way. You know, we have the Aronoff-Bohm effect. And we say, oh, it looks non-local, but don't worry about it, it's really local. Why do we say it's really local? Because we know in our heads we can introduce a vector potential and it couples locally and everything is fine. But that's at the price of a great deal of redundancy. Okay? We can be non-redundant and give up manifest locality, or redundant and keep locality. Okay. So that's the reason for all the complexity in the Feynman diagrams. We're carrying all this gauge redundant baggage about.
So is it related to the fact that you cannot write a vector, you cannot quantize a theory with vector filled without gauge symmetry? You cannot just say,
yes.
Oh,
exactly. It's exactly the same thing. I mean, there are many guises of exactly the same problem. I'm choosing to emphasize the thing that highlights the physical observable. The whole way, because we're not, in a moment, we won't be talking about Lagrangians ever again, okay? So, but I want to say, if you want to describe the S matrix or massless particles, the crucial point here is the massless particles. I should say, where did unitarity come in? Unitarity came in because it's unitary representations of the Lorentz group for massless particles that tell you that there's only helicity. So it's literally these two ingredients, unitarity and locality, boom. The only way of making them manifest is to build all this gauge redundancy in. And the gauge redundancy horrendously complicates the calculation. And furthermore, it all cancels out in the final answer, which is how the 220 terms go to one term or three terms, even at tree level. But you can't even isolate, oh, that term canceled that term. It's horribly non-locally spread out throughout the calculation. It just happens right at the end and collapses to these extremely simple results.
So okay. In this picture, if I would assume I just take gauge invariant. I just try to quantize a vector field without.
Yes, yes.
Where are you going to see the problem?
Well, if you just quantize a vector field and you're just an idiot, you write d nu a nu, you run into all sorts of problems. You have negative norm states, you have all sorts of other problems. Okay. Then you could start from that and then try to clean up the mess that you made. That's one of the standard approaches to what talking about. Most field theory textbooks take that attitude. From this point of view, that's all backwards, because the actual observable is the scattering amplitude. And you're trying to build a Lagrangian to make locality unitarity manifest. It has a job to do. That's the job it has to do. Okay? It has to ensure that these on-shell Ward identities are satisfied. And then you just have to go find the Lagrangian which makes that happen. And this gives you a good clue that it should have some gauge redundancy in it, because it needs to know that these two polarization vectors are to be identified. So this is the situation for gauge theory. For gravity, we have even more redundancy. Okay, that's the diffeomorphisms. So all this gauge redundancy is there, again, to make locality and unitarity manifest. But it comes at a big price. It makes the structure of the answer, the simplicity of the answer, it completely obscures it. Okay. So this is another very basic fact that I find in people who get into this business find absolutely mesmerizing is that there are these all highfalutin arguments of no space, time, gravity, all of that. But sitting under our noses for 60 years in the structure of good old fashioned scattering amplitudes and QED, QCD, normal theories, there's been this big clue. There's something wrong with space time. There's something wrong with taking these ideas so seriously. Because when you do, you force these horrendous complexities in the answer that are not there, in the process of computing the answer that are not there in the answer itself. There must be some way of getting this answer in another way, which doesn't put space-time in. And maybe not unitarity as well. So because all the problems have to do with putting the two of them together. Again, it'll just be a dead reformulation. So it'll be completely unitary, completely local, but those properties will be emergent and other things will become obvious. Okay. A final note. This fact that the polarization vectors don't really exist but are only a member of a redundant class is the reason why most of us in our field theory classes never saw a scattering amplitude, actually. Because it was always given in that form. So we never actually saw it. We always saw some redundant representative of it, but we never saw what the amplitude itself was. We'll talk in a moment about the variables to use, which exist very thankfully in four dimensions, that allow you to see directly what the amplitudes actually are as functions. It's the beginning of understanding underlying structure. But let me just say a few words about the development of the subject and where it is now before getting into details.
Could I ask about the Skinner field case first?
Yes.
So you're going to use this this redundancy. Once you get rid of the redundancy in the gauge field case or the gravity case,
right,
you're going to recover some much simpler formulation, which allows you to argue that we're seeing space-time emerge from a reformulation of quantum field theory.
Exactly.
The fact that you apparently don't get much of a bonus by reformulating scalar field theories is telling you what exactly?
I think it's telling us that scalar field theories are not actually aren't a fundamental part of nature, and you think of them as you think of them as bits and pieces of underlying theories with gauge theories and gravity, as we know they are. So there are five of the fourth interactions in Yang-Mills theory, or in super-Yang-Mills theory. And so there are scalars around and so on. But that's really fundamentally what it's telling us. And of course we know that, right? We know that even all by ourselves, because we know that there is something wrong with just the scalar theories. They have hierarchy problems, they don't want to survive to low energies, and so on. So in fact I find that it's yet another little push that this line of thinking is actually correct. You see, yes.
I was just going to ask a historic question about some of these motivations.
Yes.
I was just wondering whether Roger Penrose's Twister form was this.
Yes. Well, Twisters are going to play a very big role in this story.
Okay.
And I should say that Penrose understood many of these things about the importance of massless scattering amplitudes, the importance of looking at the boundary, and so on, with amazing foresight already in the mid-60s. So DeWitt understood these things. Penrose understood them very, very well. So the philosophy, this basic holographic philosophy, these guys understood cold, okay, already in the 1960s. It's an absolutely wonderful part of this story that these ideas that Penrose and his group in Oxford have been developing for 30 years finally have found a real home. And they're really, I mean, by the end of the lectures, I hope you see that you will never think about scattering amplitudes without using twisters ever again. Okay. I mean, it's just insane to think about them in any other way. But it took 40 years. It took 40 years to see it, and it wasn't, you know, but nor was it a case of, like, you know, martyrs gradually chipping away until it made sense. It was really people doing. I mean, it was a collection of things: people doing the computations in gauge theories, getting the data, mining the data, getting the data. You start seeing the data, you get more and more of the data, you start seeing patterns, you start suspecting them. This is the little bit of history I wanted to say. So, I mean, it's remarkable that all of this was largely motivated from the grungy part, the non-new physics part of Hadron Collider experiments, which is to compute the backgrounds. Okay? So this is why people did these calculations. It's really a wonderful fact about physics that good deeds are eventually rewarded. Doing sort of morally correct things are eventually rewarded. I mean, people like me, I mean, I will fully admit, we're like, oh, poor guys doing these grungy calculations, no one gives a shit about them. You know, oh well, if someone's got to do it, I'm glad it's not me. I'm being honest. This is complete, total, I always say I was a postdoc at Slack in the 90s with Lance Dixon two offices down. And had I just talked to him, you know, then my life would have been quite different. So these people were doing heroic calculations, hard calculations. Well, Maxine knows very well, he was one of the people doing these difficult, very difficult, wonderful calculations. But they were not just important for, I mean, they were important for all the things they were actually important for, but they began to develop this big amount of data to structure the answer. But there is something going on here. But these answers, it's not just a trick here or there. At first you think it's tricks. Really, it's quantum field theory. Isn't field theory amazing? It gives us these incredible answers. What explains why they're those so simple? Well, it's just field theory. Field theory is an amazing thing. But you start suspecting slowly by slowly, more and more data accumulates, more and more bizarre connections between the answers accumulate, that there really might be something going on, right? And it's not just that the answers are simple, but that there really might be another formulation. Okay. Now, this program got a huge boost from Witten in late 2003, where he suggested that there was a dual formulation of super Yang-Mills theory. I'll explain when we get into it. You'll see why it is that maximally supersymmetric theories, you would have discovered them all by yourself just thinking about scattering amplitudes, because they're so much nicer to think about scattering amplitudes than ordinary theories. And you'll see why. So maximal supersymmetry is an incredibly natural thing from the point of view of scattering amplitude. And we'll be spending a lot of time talking about that. But anyway, at tree level, it doesn't make any difference. At tree level, gluon scattering and n equals 4 scattering are just exactly the same, because the superpartners can't run into random loops. At loop level, they are obviously different. But as you'll see, the real thing about maximal supersymmetry is just that it makes kinematically talking about scattering amplitudes much simpler than pure Yang-Mills. That's very little to do with cancellations and loops and stuff like that. It's really something much more basic and hardwired into the observable that you were talking about. Anyway, so Witten made a proposal for a dual theory, precisely this thing, a dual theory, not just a trick, a collection of tricks, but a dual theory that would compute all of these scattering amplitudes that was associated with some string theory in twister space, some topological string theory in twister space. Which was really startling, because these words, twister space, dual theory, all this stuff, was now coming in and having something to do with the good old-fashioned gluon scattering. Okay, it ended up, well, at some point in these lectures, I will tell you the easy way of thinking about twister string theory. It'll be one of the many things that comes out from this dual formulation that now exists that I'll be telling you about. It ended up being difficult to do calculations of the twister string theory itself. There are reasons to suspect that it didn't work at loop level, but it inspired many developments. And in fact, it inspired many developments for the much more effective and fast computation of tree amplitudes in the form of new recursion relations for the tree amplitudes. First, these so-called Picciozzo, Svirchek, Witten recursion relations, then the Brito, Picciozzo, Friend, Witten, the BCFW recursion relations. The BCFW recursion relations in particular were extremely important. They're extremely important for two reasons. A, they're really, really, really efficient. So they allowed people to generate lots of data. Okay? Just for tree amplitudes in gauge theories and in gravity, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 particles, you could start computing them and actually seeing what the answers looked like. Okay? That was one thing. But secondly, while the people eventually understood the CSW rules as essentially being a very, very clever version of light cone gauge. Okay? But they're still Feynman diagrams. They're Feynman diagrams where the vertices were associated with MHV, these maximal helicity violating amplitudes that I'll tell you more about. But they still look like Feynman diagrams. The BCFW recursion relations finally didn't even look like Feynman diagrams. They didn't look like they came from Lagrangian. And these very short forms of the answer that I told you, there's three terms of the answer for the six particle amplitudes is when you compute it from BCFW. And they have the following remarkable property. That, you know, if someone hands you an amplitude, you can ask, and you didn't know it came from a Lagrangian, someone just handed you an object, say, this is an amplitude. you could ask, how could you tell whether it's consistent with any kind of local space-time description or not? You can tell by seeing the kinds of poles that this object has. Okay. Because if I have the external particles, 1 through up to n, then the allowed kinds of poles that we can have, we know, correspond to long-distance propagation in space-time. And that means that the amplitude should have poles that look like 1 over some sum of the subset of the momenta squared. And furthermore, the residue on that pole, the residue on that pole should factorize into some tree amplitude on the left times some tree amplitude on the right. So locality is sitting there in plain sight in the singularity structure of the amplitude. This is even at tree level. Okay? Just even there at the tree level. What was remarkable about the BCFW form of the amplitudes is that they gave the answer in the terms of a few terms, some of a small number of terms, but each term individually did not have a local interpretation. Each term individually had some poles that were local and some poles that were not local. The poles that were not local, just to give you an example, is if so you have some, let's say, if we call these sort of sums of momenta capital P, the sorts of singularities you're allowed to have are 1 over p squared, but for example, not 1 over p squared, q squared, minus r squared, p squared. Okay? That's a not local pole. And each individual BCFW term is rifled, is riddled with those. Okay? So there's local poles, there's non-local poles. Of course, miraculously, when you sum the terms together, the three terms together, you find these non-local poles cancel, and you're only left with the local ones. Okay? But somehow you see even more vividly that you're gaining simplicity at the expense of locality. Okay? You're gaining simplicity at the expense of allowing objects that could never possibly come from an underlying local theory. Okay? So that was a very, very striking, that was a very striking feature of these BCFW rules. Now, all of this.
This was a three-level argument. This was a three-level argument.
This was just a tree level.
Okay.
Just a tree level.
Because we know they are not there. I mean, once you include loop, then the pole gets shifted by quantum correction. Once we include loops in the propagator that you draw, then the pole gets shifted.
Of course, and we have branch cuts and so on. So it's but let's just talk about the just the tree level. That was just a tree level statement. Okay. So now yet another thing that happened in a completely parallel development is that people started studying. People have been studying planar n equals 4 super Yang-mills. Okay, so n equals 4 on the large n limit. and notice that a funny curiosity that in just looking at the multi-loop structure, the kinds of integrals that occurred at multi-loop level had a strange feature. They had a new kind of symmetry. They had a new sort of conformal symmetry that they called dual conformal symmetry. I'll tell you what it is in a second. It'll be hard to describe at the moment exactly how they saw it, but I'll tell you what it is in a second. But I want to say that it was first noticed by people doing perturbative calculations, just seeing that the multi-loop integrals had a funny symmetry that was unanticipated. This was really correctly, and vividly understood by Aldai and Maldacena, who started looking at amplitudes at strong coupling using ADS-CFT, and seeing that in ADS-CFT it was natural to introduce a sort of T-duality that mapped the calculation of scattering amplitudes, just gluon scattering amplitudes at strong coupling, to the computation of a certain expectation value of a Wilson loop at strong coupling, but a Wilson loop whose edges were null. So let me describe now what this dual conformal symmetry is. That was the history, but let me describe what it is. If we're interested in scattering amplitudes of in general, any scattering amplitudes, we can pull out the color factor out of everything and just sum over all possible permutations of 1 through n, each one dressed with its own color factor. And if we're talking about the large N limit, we're only interested in single trace operators. So we'll actually focus all of our attention on one of these so-called color strip amplitudes, which are a function of 1 through n. And in a general non-supersymmetric theory, they also have felicity labels. Later, we'll talk about how to more nicely talk about it supersymmetrically, and what the correct variables are. But let me just for this purpose, just for the purpose of introducing what dual conformal symmetry is, it suffices to notice that there's a natural cyclic structure to the external part. Now, momentum is conserved, so you can imagine laying the momenta of the particles end to end on a four-dimensional sheet of paper. So if this is momentum p1, p2, p3, to pn, then they form a closed polygon. We can make this say this formally by saying that we can write the eighth momentum as a difference like that. The difference between two coordinates. Okay? These are funny coordinates. They're not ordinary space-time coordinates. They're units or momenta. They're units of momentum. Okay? But because there's a natural cyclic ordering, there is this natural polygon associated with the problem. And there is this natural dual space X in which the momenta, which give you the vertices of the polygon. Okay? You'll notice that there's some redundancy here. Obviously, I can translate everything and get exactly the same piece. Okay, what people notice is that the scattering amplitudes, appropriately defined after you do a few canonical things to them, well, I'll even tell you what you have to do to them. So normally, when we have scattering amplitudes, there is a delta function of momentum conservation sitting in front of everything. Okay? In a supersymmetric theory, there is a super partner as well. So there's the delta function of the supercharge, the delta function of the momentum, times something. Okay? This whole picture only makes sense on the support of that delta function. Okay? So the statement is, if you take the amplitude and you strip off the trivial delta functions that conserve momentum and supermomentum, then you have a resulting object that makes sense now only on the support of those delta functions. Okay? But that object is invariant under a new conformal symmetry. And the conformal symmetry is conformal transformations on this space.
So the dimensionality is the same, right?
Dimensionality is the same. Everything is the same. But there's a dual conformal invariant.
Is it the Lorentz invariant part of the amplitude? So you take away.
Yeah, so if you just take away the trivial delta functions, the thing which is left is invariant bizarrely under this under conformal transformations in this space. For example, it's invariant under inversions. If you take x mu and you replace it with x mu over x squared, the amplitude is invariant. Completely crazy. You would expect this if these x's were space-time coordinates, because n equals 4 is conformal in space-time. Now, at loop level, there's confusions about what we should be talking about. There's infrared divergences and the amplitudes and so on. But even if we just stick with tree level, at tree level, there's a well-defined sense in which conformal transformations act on the amplitudes. That's obvious in the Lagrangian. Great. Okay.
So but in n equals 4, when disappear
could? At tree level, it's also for pure QCD. Okay. So it's an exact statement apparently only at tree level. We'll see later when we talk about things more. It's actually symmetry of the full loop integrand, which is a sensible object to all loop orders.
So it's correct also in a non-supersymmetric theory.
At tree level, this is some hidden symmetry of QCD that no one ever knew about. This is what I'm telling you. These things have been lying under people's noses for. This could have been noticed in principle 30 years ago, okay? No one knew to look. No one knew to look that sitting there, the actual answer to the six particle and scattering amplitude is some crazy symmetry in this dual space.
Okay. Does the same hold for higher dimensional Daniels there?
No. Well, yes, actually, at three-level it does. But I can tell you a little more about that later. Of course, higher dimensional theories have problems at loop level. But at three-level, in a specific sense, it does. Okay, so I think, so far in this story, the main hint that there was some dual formulation was the simplicity of the answer. Simplicity. This, I think, just puts the final nail in the coffin of the Lagrangian. Because this is now an honest to goodness symmetry the theory has, just as big as the symmetries that see us in front of our face, but which are completely obscured in the Lagrangian. Normally in physics, when you have symmetries, okay, it's not aesthetics, is it simple, not simple, you know, it's your job to figure out how to talk about the physics so that you make all the symmetries manifest.
Since there's a symmetry, there should be a conserved quantum.
There are, actually. That's actually extremely interesting. The reason, there's an infinite power of conserved quantities, actually. So if you take this symmetry and the ordinary conformal symmetry, they don't commute with each other. I should say, this is like a T-duality, right? This is really, and this is actually where it came from in ABS-CFT. It came from an actual T-duality. It's like a T-duality. It's a space where the coordinates are the inverse of the usual coordinates, okay? They don't commute with each other. Okay? These symmetries and the other symmetries do not commute with each other. And in fact, they close into an infinite dimensional algebra. It's called a Yangian. There's an infinite dimensional Yangian algebra. Okay? You don't even need to know what the Yangian is or what a Yangian algebra is, but I'll use the word Yangian over and over again to refer to what you get from combining both conformal and dual conformal invariants. In other words, there's an infinite dimensional symmetry. Now, you might ask, as Chava was about to ask, I think, doesn't this violate the Coleman-Mangula theorem? Doesn't it violate all these things? And it doesn't, because these are extremely interesting symmetries. They are not symmetries that have well-defined action on one particle states. You see it here. You see, even what the symmetry is depends on all n particles. Okay. So the way it acts mixes up particles with their neighbors in an interesting way. So it doesn't have action on single states, so it doesn't violate. It's yet another loophole of the Coleman-Mangula theorem. anyway, it's true. There is an infinite dimensional symmetry, which is there in n equals 4. Now we understand n equals 4 in a specific sense, the infinite loop order. Okay, but it's certainly there at tree level, even for pure QCD. But you write down negative a quarter f mu squared, where is this? Okay. It isn't there. Negative a quarter f mu squared is letting you see half of the symmetry. In a sense, one over infinity of the symmetry, but one half of it, and the other half is totally obscure. Okay.
And yes. Speaking purely from this application, is there a very clever way that I can exploit the symmetry to compute amplitudes by just computing one quantity and then just a few quantities and then actually using this to get the whole answer?
Roughly speaking, very roughly speaking, that's what we're going to be doing. Okay. So very roughly speaking, that is exactly what we're going to be doing. I'm just still going a little historically here. Just to say that when this happens, you now are just convinced there must be a second way. Because again, what's making it impossible to see this is your adherence to local spacetime. If you're picking the original spacetime, you'll make the other conformal symmetry manifest. You can pick the other one. You're computing a Wilson loop on that side. Why the heck is there a scattering amplitude in the other space? God knows. Okay? You can commit to one space or the other, and the commitment to any local description obscures this infinite dimensional symmetry. Okay.
So again, what is this? How you call this symmetry?
Dual.
No, this infinite.
The Yangian.
How they related to Lie groups?
I can explain that. I mean, I can tell you, but it's utterly irrelevant to any practical application. There's a particular way of taking some Lie algebra and now attaching indices to the generators. Okay, now people do this all the time. You build infinite dimensional algebras out of ordinary Lie algebras. But there's a specific way that you can do it. A specific grading and a specific funny cubic relation that has to be satisfied between these generalized structure constants, known as the Sayre relation, that allows one of these infinite dimensional algebras to be a particularly special, nice one called the Yangian. Okay.
Okay, so in the subset of the, what do you call it?
I don't even know what the whole big space is called. But,
the subset of this affine.
Yes, a subset of these gigantic big algebras are these things which are okay. Triangles. In practice, they're the thing that you get by commuting conformal and dual conformal invariants. Okay? I could tell you, but I have to learn it myself. So, I think, amongst other things, we're going to be writing on a formula that generates all Yangian invariants. And I'm very proud to have written this formula down without actually knowing what the Yangian algebra is. this official definition. But anyway, this is what it is in practice. Okay, so. So the suspense grows, right? So the theory has this other symmetry. Now, how did people see that the symmetry was there in tree amplitudes? Well, they took their various favorite forms of the tree amplitude, like the BCFW formula, and they found really remarkably that the individual terms in BCFW were individually both conformal and dual conformal invariants. So that was really, really interesting, right? Because now these terms seem to be like building blocks that know about all the symmetries of the theory. This now explains why they weren't local. They couldn't possibly be local because they're serving two masters, right? They're trying to make conformal invariants in ordinary spacetime and the dual spacetime manifest at the same time. Of course, they can't be local. Okay? But they are showing that the symmetry exists. So A, they're coming from some place that knows that it's possible to be invariant under both things. But B, they have to be put together in a really interesting way in order for the non-local poles to cancel and be left with local poles. So you see, going from all these like highfalutin, somewhat vague, airy-fairy questions about the emergence of space-time, all of a sudden, we're left with a very, very sharp set of questions. Where do the BCFW terms come from? Is there a generating function for them? Is there something that spits them all out? And secondly, how can you understand, how do you see that when you sum them up, all the non-local terms cancel? That's the rule that tells you where local space-time physics comes from, right? Because the individual ones don't do it. We'll see it in more detail when you actually see what the expressions look like. But the remarkable thing is that each individual, as I said, the fact that these non-local poles cancel turn into identities between rational functions, you know, functions of ratios of momenta, invariants built out of momenta. These rational function identities look insane. You would never think that they're true. Okay? There are really remarkable many, many term identities that have to be satisfied. And yet, they are satisfied. Okay? So now it's possible, as we'll discuss, it's possible to derive BCFW from quantum field theory, and that gives an indirect derivation of these facts, because we know these non-local poles aren't there. But it's a really roundabout way of just generating these very sharp identities. So the question arises, is there some more direct way of understanding where these identities come from? And whatever that way is, has got to give us some insight into where local space-time physics comes from. Okay? And a formulation that gives us these terms correctly. All right, so I'm going to greatly accelerate the story of the history. So this is substantially what many of the introductions of various talks that I and many other people given over the last number of years have looked like even a year ago or a year and a half ago to all orders of perturbation theory, to all loop orders, which gives you not the scattering amplitude directly, but actually the thing that you integrate to get the scattering amplitude, the integrand of the scattering amplitudes. As we'll discuss, it's a very important feature of planar theories that the integrand of the scattering amplitudes is a well-defined notion. It's not a well-defined notion for a general theory. For planar theory, it is a well-defined notion. So there is a machine that spits out the integrand of scattering amplitudes. Okay? It does it in a way that makes the Yangian invariants completely manifest. Each term manifests the Yangian invariant. And it actually generalizes, it generalizes the BCFW recursion relations with tree amplitudes to all loop work. Okay? So the fact that there is some, it doesn't say the word Lagrangian once, there isn't the word gauge invariance once. Okay? And furthermore, of course, it's really, really fast. So you can use it to compute not just tree amplitudes, but one loop, two loop, three loop amplitudes. It's just a matter of the hitting shift enter in Mathematica and waiting a few microseconds, and you have the answer. But more important than that is the fact that it's really showing that this picture exists. There is a dual theory. The angular invariance is manifest. Individual terms aren't local, and there is the 10% which is missing is a completely independent, completely autonomous understanding of why you selected these particular objects to put together to make local visits. Although even that's understood and is being more and more understood now for a variety of that's the one thing which is left. The thing that ends up making some work that just came out around a month ago now, or month and a half ago, and in the intervening weeks. Various other things have been completely cleaned up and understood now, finally. For example, there's that picture of the Wilson loop that I told you about. And for a long time, people wanted to know precisely what that object was. The full supersymmetric object. What's the super generalization of this Wilson loop that allows you to put in helicity information as well? Okay. That object has been discovered. So. What this integrand is, what its name is in ordinary spacetime, its scattering amplitude. Its name in the dual spacetime is a certain specific sort of Wilson loop. The fact that this Wilson loop and the amplitude are the same is understood. So large, and all of these equalities are understood and established at the level of the integrand. Okay? That's a significant development because we now have in our hands. Gigantic amounts of data. Okay, we, in a sense, know the whole answer. Remarkably, there is evidence that not just the integrand is simple, but the integrals are simple. That's yet another story. Many of these things end up being related to an observation made a little over a year ago. Everything about n equals 4 scattering amplitudes seems to be associated with a certain contour integral over the space of k-dimensional planes in n dimensions. Okay. So an object that that mathematicians have loved and talked about for 150 years, the space of k-dimensional planes in n dimensions is known as the Grassmannian, and people of mathematicians have loved playing around in this space for all this time. It's one of the classic areas. You open up any undergraduate textbook in algebraic geometry, and chapter 4, there's some discussion of the Grassmannian. After you talk about projective spaces, you would talk about Grassmannians. But anyway, it's a very specific contour integral over the Grassmannian. What these words have to do with scattering amplitudes is not obvious, and I'll make obvious tomorrow. But this is this was one of the remarkable things is that such a very basic and deep and old and beautiful part of math that had never had anything to do with physics in any particularly important way was actually sitting there smack heart dab in the middle of the structure of gauge theory scattering amplitudes. And you'll see why it is that this Grassmannian formulation completely liberates you from any particular spacetime description. So the object you're talking about is some contour integral. So we ask the question, what would emergent spacetime look like? This is not the question that you can ask abstractly. You need to have an example. You need to look at what a possible answer looks like. And this is a possible answer. I don't know if it's the whole answer. I don't know if it's the relevant answer. But it's a possible answer that there is some abstract object, which is a contour integral over this totally auxiliary space. And interesting topological properties of the contour encode spacetime locality. And unitarity, now that we understand all loops.
we can understand that both the unitarity and locality are encoded in topological properties of the allowed contours of integration. This Grassmannian picture ends up being very closely related in certain way of thinking about it to the twister string theory. So it contains the twister string theory. It ends up, it contains the BCFW recursion relations. That's one of the things that inspired it. But it also contains the CSW rules. It contains, in different representations of this contour, it contains essentially every way anyone had ever seen to write down scattering amplitudes are seen as different contour choices which can be smoothly deformed into each other on one basic algebraic geometric object. Okay. And that's what I will spend some time explaining over the course of the rest of the lectures. It's also associated with a new picture of what loops are, which, as you'll see, suggests that there's really one object, depending on perhaps an infinite number of particles, and there's canonical rules for removing particles. It's as if you're not looking at them, you're hiding them. You don't want to see what all these other particles are doing. There's some simple canonical rules for removing particles. And if you do them one at a time, if you remove particles one at a time, nothing interesting happens. You would go from a big tree amplitude down to a little tree amplitude. But it turns out that if you remove one particle and then the next, there's essentially a unique second way of removing pairs of particles that entangles them in a specific way. Not standard quantum entanglement, entangles in a specific way I'll tell you about. You're sort of integrating over particle one and two, and there is an entangled contour of integration that you can choose to remove both of them. That operation is where loop amplitudes come from. So in a very specific sense, hiding pairs of particles is where quantum mechanics is coming from. Okay. As I said, there's still a number of things left to much more deeply understand what this object is, but all the data is in front of us, and I think that there will be lots and lots of progress in the next little while. So that's the plan for the remainder of the lectures. I want to tell you what the story is, essentially, of the integrand for n equals 4 superangulars, making all the symmetries manifest, making this connection to this underlying Grassmannian structure manifest, and drawing you some pictures in the simplest cases where we understand things perfectly well of ultimately what this invariant thing is that the amplitudes are. They're roughly speaking like volumes in some abstract space. And depending on they're volumes of some polytopes in some abstract space. And depending on how you triangulate these polytopes, you get different representations of the amplitude that make different things obvious. Okay? Some of those representations are the CSW rules, and they make space-time in some light cone gauge manifest. Some of them are the BCFW rules, and make the Yangian symmetry totally manifest. It turns out something that we've discovered recently is that there are other ways of chopping them up that actually give you new expressions for the scattering amplitudes that are completely local, which are not Feynman diagrams. Okay? And these end up reproducing the one idea from the past that had not been absorbed in this business was the very first set of recursion relations that were invented by Behrens and Walter Hiele, known as the Behrens-Hiele recursion relations. These were the methods, much more Feynman diagram-based, that people had used in this heroic earlier epoch of doing the hard calculations. They had managed to get up to seven particle amplitudes using these recursion relations. Well, we now understand that those expressions are actually yet other ways of slicing up these polytopes. And that geometric picture allows us to generalize the expressions to all numbers of particles, for example. Okay? So I'm giving you a rough idea of what it looks like. Roughly speaking, in one representation, it's some contour integral over an abstract mathematical space. In a yet another representation of it, it's some kind of volume of a polytope. In both cases, you have to choose representatives, representative of the contour, or a representative of a triangulation of the polytope. And different representations make different things manifest. In none of the representations is there a Lagrangian, or a gauge symmetry, or anything like that. Okay, so after that very lengthy introduction, I think I'll leave it for tomorrow. We'll start way back down on the ground, and I'll introduce the spin and helicity variables, the supersymmetric variables, the nice ways of talking about these n equals 4 scattering amplitudes, and I'll begin introducing this Grassmannian description. Thanks a lot.
Can I ask you one thing? So I never mentioned crossing symmetry.
Yeah. Crossing symmetry is always there. Yes, it's always there. In this, in fact, if you like, the existence of crossing symmetry is yet another one of these early indications that there's something wrong with the usual way of thinking about scattering amplitudes. Because normally, you think about scattering amplitudes as n goes to out. You wouldn't suspect there was such a thing as crossing symmetry. Then you discover it in the answer, like, oh, look at that. I could just call the energy negative energy, imagine they're all incoming, I get the antiparticle answers just by swinging around, right? Of course, it has a pretty quick derivation, okay? But still, it's not baked in to the structure of the problem, right? It's yet another thing that's telling you, hold on, that there's some other, that this is something else, right? That's right, so from the very beginning, we're imagining all momenta are incoming, and we don't even say anything about how to interpret the negative energy part, the negative energy ones. Later, you can say the negative energy ones are the antiparticle outgoing, and so on.
So what is your starting point now that you don't have Lagrangian? So your starting point, just say these are the fields?
No, we don't even say the word fields.
Particles.
Say these are the particles. I should say one more very important thing related to this. Some of the motivation in philosophy sounds a lot like the S-matrix program, okay? And it shares with the S-matrix program the desire to compute the S-matrix. Okay? However, but there's two very, very big differences. One of them is practical and one of them is philosophical. The practical one is that the poor S-matrix people, even though their heart was in the right place, turned out to be focusing on the hardest, worst possible theory to apply their techniques. Not QCD, they didn't even know about QCD. The scattering of scalars, which were massive, okay? The scattering of massive scalars. They were terrified of massless particles. You open up the analytic S matrix everywhere, they say there's a mass gap so we can have our nice analytic ellipse, and you know, blah, blah, blah. They hated massless particles. They were terrified of infrared furnaces. They said they're not there anyway, except for the photon and the graviton, but who cares about them? Okay. and the scalars are great, because every now and then they talk about spin, but they say, oh, that's a bit of a pain in the ass. You gotta put spin in, and okay. So you see, from our point of view, the theory they should have been working on is like n equals 4 super Young Mills or n equals 8 supergravity, but they would never have known that. They would have never known that. That's one. But two, another very, very important difference is their whole attitude was that all you had to do was impose unitarity and causality and you'd get the right answer. And there would be a unique answer, right? And this was just sort of crazy from the get-go, because there are other theories, like QED is a great theory, you know? There are tons of Lagrangians you could write down. They clearly were going to satisfy all of these rules. There was no unique answer, right? So you don't go in, and plus, related to that, no one actually knew exactly what the imprint of locality was, what the imprint of causality was, how to decide these things exactly. In fact, if you look at the old books, what they do is get on their high horse about they're going to compute things with these big principles, then they go look at the back of the book at what Feynman diagrams gave you, right? So, oh, these are the kind of singularities that are allowed because we get them from Feynman diagrams. Okay, great, forget that we cheated. Now we go back on our high horse, we'll apply the same principles. You see, it didn't make any sense. Our attitude is completely different. It's not that we're going to impose unitarity and causality and locality. It's totally the other way around. We're going to find some natural theory that doesn't have space-time in it, has some other ingredients, find it, and see them as an output. Exactly. See causality and locality and unitarity as an output, not an input.
So, again,
so the philosophy is totally backwards.
So what is your input? You say I have a world with particles?
We'll see starting tomorrow. We'll see starting tomorrow. What we'll start doing is just getting a good idea of what these functions are that we're after. The simplest way to talk about them. So that's why we'll introduce these spinner helicity variables and these super variables that allow us to talk about the super amplitudes nicely. So finally, there's a collection of functions out there. There are some nice collection of functions that come out of computing Feynman diagrams. You might imagine, could they come out of somewhere else? Okay.
So particles now, are also emerging, like space-time, or particles?
No, particles are an input. Particles, just the external states
are input.
Are definitely input.
And space-time would be emerging.
Space-time will be an output. That's right. And then you'll see. You see, this is why this is such a fun business. There are no rules. It's just like beyond the standard model of physics, except there's data. And it definitely has something to do with the world. You look at the structure of gauge scattering amplitudes, and then you force yourself to see where could it possibly come from that's not a Lagrangian. And you'll see that we'll be directly led to this Grassmannian picture by focusing on the apparently most boring part of the standard scattering amplitude answer, namely the momentum conserving delta function. We'll stare at the momentum-conserving delta function for quite a while, and we'll realize that it's telling us something. And actually, just reinterpreting the momentum-conserving delta function in a new way in a couple of steps will lead to this Grassmannian contra-integral formula, which is one formula that seems to know everything about scattering amplitudes all over the course. And it sounds surprising that you should be able to go so far from the momentum-conserving delta function, except it's the usual thing about dualities. The things that are trivial from one point of view will be non-trivial from the other point of view, and vice versa. The momentum-conserving delta function is trivial because it's the one part of standard scattering amplitudes that really damn well knows about the spacetime. Where does it come from? It comes from d4x. It knows about that x inside. It's d4ing it. Okay. It's integrating over that whole d4x. It knows about translations beautifully. Okay. And that's where the delta function comes from. If you're not putting it in the inside of the spacetime, that momentum-conserving delta function is not going to be easy. And so thinking about where it might come from is actually almost the entire story, as we'll see. So, but as I said, there aren't any rules. So we've had some success with n equals 4. Some part of the problem is just solved for n equals 4, or in the planar theory for the integrand. But it's now just really solved to all the forms. But what do you do for non-planar theory? What do you do for pure QCD? What do you do for gravity? There's a whole program here to reformulate all of physics eviscerating the space-time. And by the way, given that we've done it for this theory that seems to have this gigantic integrable structure, this huge infinite dimensional symmetry, you could really be a pessimist and say, oh, this is so special to n equals 4, it's never going to happen for anything else, it's just this accident that you have this infinite dimensional symmetry, that's all it is. Good luck doing it for anything else. That's one possible attitude. Another attitude is, no, maybe there's some hint, even if it's not exactly there, it's broken in some way. There is this underlying structure controlling everything. And because there has to be, because of these highfalutin reasons about being able to take the correspondence limit of a theory with gravity, which doesn't have space-time in it, and landing on a theory which shouldn't have space-time in it either. So it's really, I think right now, there's a very interesting breakpoint here. Because you know, there is an existence proof, basically. I can hand you a theory that up to this 10%, 20%, whatever that's left, it basically does, you know, fulfills the fantasy. But we need another example. We need to see, you know, can it be done for pure QCD? Can it be done for anything else? I think if you can see that it's also happening to theories that aren't this perfect crystalline jewel, like n equals 4, then I think we'll be, then there's really something to do to just carry it out for everything else. Also, anything for gravity, even for n equals 8. I should say that I very, very strongly suspect, we've had wonderful fun with the n equals 4, I really strongly suspect it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's going on in gravity. And it's just because the zeroth order things that have been accomplished for n equals 4 for Yang-Mills theories, very basic kinematical things like color stripping, you know, things that just allow you to talk about the amplitude in the simplest possible way. These things have not been done for gravity yet. So it's still at a primitive stage. Even at the level of data, it's at a primitive stage. Initial cleanup work has got to be done. But I'm positive that there's a much richer and more intricate and deeper structure for gravity than for Yang-Mills.
I wanted to ask about when you made the analogy, the ghost theorist teacher, as we call it.
Yes.
And you talked about the least action principle and reformulating some of the least action principles gave you most of the way there to kind of getting rid of determinants.
Right.
But there still was equivalent class from that, saying you had this small additional step to go to quantum mechanics. So, in terms of what you've done, if basically you found in a reformulation like that's equivalent to, say, n equals 4 or something,
right,
angle. Are there any hints yet about an additional small set might be?
I honestly think we don't understand it well enough yet to know. See, it's like I think our understanding is, like, and I think um, I, I, I really want to stress the this point. I think, you know, we've established a kind of beachhead. But even for n equals 4, for planar n equals 4, or everything, just we have not extracted the lesson yet. Okay, we know how to do the calculations. We know, you know, we can see the symmetry. You know, we're a long way. You know, we've severed the ropes that were connecting us to quantum field theory. Okay, we're definitely doing things without quantum field theory now, standard quantum field theory. But I don't think we yet really understand understand very deeply the object. So there is this last 10 or 20% is going to be very, very important for actually. And I think until we do, I can't really give a good answer. There are some vague hints. There are some very, very vague hints. For example, these Grassmannians naturally live inside bigger spaces, and so you might imagine. I mean, you know, but this is really, this is the kind of often useless mathematical speculation that goes nowhere. But you might imagine that there's some generalization of what we're doing that will allow fluctuations off the sort of Grassmannian subsurface into this bigger space, and that might have something to do with gravity. This is too abstract. You'll have to see what it actually looks like. Just kinematically, it turns out that using twister space is just the best way of talking about scattering amplitudes. And in this dual space, there's an analog of the twister space known as momentum twister space, which is the best way of talking about scattering amplitudes. So twister space is kinematics here. You know, it's just a basis. It's a basis to use in discussing the external particles. It just turns out to be a shockingly powerful and useful basis that allows you to see symmetry that you would not otherwise see. And I should have also mentioned, I mean, that it'll come up again and again, but there are many, you know, the heroes in this business. I mean, early on, of course, there's the Fermilab people, there's Lance V, David Kossauer, Edward, obviously. Freddy Cochazzo's name is all over the story post-2003. I don't think there's one development that hasn't figured in some important way. A lot of young people, names like James Drummond, Johannes Hahn, Dave Skip, Oxford people, Lionel Mason, and my favorite of this whole crowd of people is a student of Penrose's named Andrew Hodges, who just turned 60 this year, and who has been working on the subject his entire career. So Penrose in 1970, well, even earlier than that, but very clearly 1972, saw a connection between his twisters and Feynman diagrams. And he invented something called twister diagrams, which looked to him a very natural analog to Feynman diagrams. And they were complicated contour integrals in twister space. And he went on and on saying these things were very important. Certainly no part of this has paid any attention to it whatsoever. Andrew Hodges worked on this problem from back then. He was, I think, one of Penrose's first graduate students. And he worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And he made huge amounts of progress, understanding how to do these contour integrals in more and more realistic settings. Again, no one paying the slightest whit of attention to it whatsoever. His papers sat on my desk for 2 years because they had the following bizarre feature that I read the introduction, I read the conclusions, and it seemed completely sane and sober and totally sensible, and the words were very exciting. And then I read the middle of the paper, I had not one idea what he was talking about. Zero. He had these insane looking pictures. It wasn't even done in tech, it was done in Word. everything other than the intro and conclusions and the fact that he was at Oxford and Penrose was a student and all these things would say crackpot. Okay? But check the intro and conclusions, which were totally sensible, right? So as it turned out, he was dead right about everything. Just every single thing. Realizing this is kind of like, I still have a lot of emotion about it because it's like a standard conversion story, right? You know, you think, oh, crackpot, 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 and then it works for you once. In the midst of, we rediscovered many of these things, but it was painful going for a while until we saw that we started realizing up. And what he realized, actually, I didn't mention one thing interesting sociologically, that Witten's paper came out, people got extremely excited about twisters for 6 months. And then it became clear that the twister string theory became clear. It still hasn't been proven, by the way. But people thought that it wouldn't work at loop level, and it died. This is a classic string theory fad, okay? Not amongst great string theorists, but amongst the unwashed masses. Okay, it died just because of that reason. I think there's a big sigh of relief that no one had to learn all this weird twister stuff. Okay. And then what came out of it were all these computational tools for BCFW, CSW, and then people gave field theory derivations of them. So it was all Witten's work inspired all these things, but really secretly it's all quantum field theory. It's all fantastic and great, but forget about all this twister stuff. Right at the moment twisters died, there was a conference. I mean, I wasn't in the field then, but basically the moment it died, Andrew Hodges gave a talk in Oxford where he said, no, it's totally the other way around. These twisters are the natural home for the BCFW recursion relations. They're actually formulated in twister space. That seemed completely nuts because this is really, as I said, at the time people were breathing this big sigh of relief, they didn't have to learn twisters. And in fact, BCFW had a beautiful classic field theory derivation. It's in Tony Z's textbook now. It's textbook material, it's just beautiful. Comes from quantum field theory, just great. Just absolutely beautiful. Not one reason to suspect it has anything to do with the twisters. Except Hodges, who said, this thing I've been doing for 30 years, these twister diagrams, they weren't Feynman diagrams. They were BCFW terms the whole time. Okay? So they're really computing BCFW terms. And I got it now, this is great. Guys, this is amazing, right? Nobody paid attention. Okay, they're too busy breathing the big sigh of relief. Then we realize in a very circuitous way that BCFW is naturally formulated in twister space. So this was this was at least for us the sort of rebirth of the twister ideas. And then we started actually trying to do calculations. And you know, the calculations got long and messy, so we started inventing some diagrams to keep track of things. And the diagrams were messy, and at some point we realized, wait a minute, these diagrams look like Hodges' diagrams. So we went to his papers, and sure enough, they started looking similar, except he was doing things much more intelligently than we were. So the conversion experience was just saying, assume he's right. Let's see, we want to do this five-particle amplitude. What would we do to make it look like his picture? We have no idea the words he's saying. Nothing. But we said, that just trying to go to that target, all of a sudden, awesome things started happening. The six particle, the seven particle, and it's completely clear he knew what he was doing. Actually, by this point, there was no rational reason for people to not believe him, because while early on, he wasn't giving any results that other people didn't know. So you could always say, yeah, he's just BSing, drawing all these diagrams, and borrowing someone else's answer. By the last paper that he wrote in this period, he was just doing computations no one had ever done before, getting the right answers, and so on. So, you know, that there was something going on. But anyway, he shortly after invented this idea of momentum twister space to understand dual conformal symmetry. And all these developments in the past year and a half have been going really, you know, there's a small group of people, Oxford people, perimeter people, other Europeans, but it's been a big collective effort. Everyone has seen one or other big part of the story. But it's wonderful that these Oxford guys were not smoking crack after all. It took a long time to listen.